Today on the 21st show, the restaurant chain Red Lobster emerged from bankruptcy last year with new ownership and a new CEO. Damola Adamulekun, a 36-year-old immigrant from Nigeria who spent part of his childhood in central Illinois. We'll talk with him about the changing restaurant landscape, his plans for the company, and childhood memories of eating at the Red Lobster in Springfield. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today we're going to be talking about one of America's most iconic restaurant brands.
Red Lobster is where America goes for seafood.
Seafood we just don't have at home.
Come to Red Lobster. There are 11 complete dinners, $9.99 for less.
There's always something new for the seafood lover in you.
It's endless shrimp. Indulge in endless choices of your favorite shrimp dishes. While the shrimp are endless, this offer isn't.
We got tail shrimp, waiters, potatoes, sauces, the bosses, cheddar beer, stuffing, no bluffing.
No bluffing.
Founded in 1968, Red Lobster once had more than 600 locations across the U.S., Canada, and overseas franchises. But last year, the $2 billion revenue company went into bankruptcy, reorganized, and came out with new ownership and new leadership. The company has sought to revamp operations, make changes to its menu, and close a few locations. According to USA Today, five Illinois Red Lobsters have closed, including in Bourbonnais, Danville, and Peoria. But that means 22 are still open, including in downstate communities such as Rockford, Peru, Bloomington, Champaign, Decatur, Springfield, Marion, Alton, and Fairview Heights. All these changes are being led by the company's 36-year-old CEO, Damola Adamulekun. Born in Nigeria, Adamulekun immigrated to the U.S. when he was 9 years old. His father was a neurosurgeon, moved his family to Springfield, Illinois in the late 1990s. And that's where Damola says he had his first experience of Red Lobster. Adamulekun would go on to earn degrees from Brown University and the Harvard Business School and was previously the CEO at the Asian fusion restaurant chain P.F. Chang's. Damola Adamulekun joins us now. Welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
If you have a business question or a Red Lobster experience you want to share, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right. I want to talk a little bit about your background and your Illinois connections. Take us back to that moment when you first come to the U.S. Again, you were born in Nigeria. I understand you grew up in Zimbabwe and the Netherlands. What is it like coming to Springfield, Illinois?
You know, it was very exciting for me and for my family. My parents worked very hard to bring us to the States, and it took a long time to bring that to fruition. We landed in Chicago at O'Hare Airport, and I was very excited to be in America. And we took a train down to Springfield, settled in, started school, and we're off to the races. So it was a very exciting time, and enjoyed my formative experiences in Springfield, Illinois.
So talk about what, say a little bit more about what you brought your family there. I mentioned your father was a surgeon. Was this part of his training or was he coming here to work?
Yeah, my father was a neurologist. He practiced in Nigeria at the time and he won an award. He helped to cure a disease in West Africa that was, they were calling it the shaking sickness. They didn't know what was causing it, but it was a neurological disorder that was being caused by what folks were eating. And he wrote a paper to help solve that issue and saved a lot of lives in the process. And he was published in the American Neurological Society. And that was his first time ever coming to the States is when they brought him out to present his research and to receive an award. So he came to New York, that would have been the early 90s, and fell in love with it, decided he wanted to move his family here and started the process to do that. Now it's a long process. It takes several years. So we didn't move here until 1990. We got to the States in 1997. So it took a few years, but that's the impetus. It was just a decision. He wanted to come to America. He fell in love with it. He wanted to raise his family here, and he took the steps to make that happen.
So I want to ask you about, because I've heard you say in other interviews that your first Red Lobster experience was in Springfield. You would have been, I don't know what, 9, 10 years old. I took my own 9-year-old son to Red Lobster the other day, and I'm trying to imagine what he's going to remember about that visit when he's in his 30s. So with that big grain of salt, I wonder what you do remember about Red Lobster, in Springfield.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of people tell me they had their first experience cracking crab legs or pulling lobster tails out of the shells at a Red Lobster, right? So it's not something that even though you have a lot of meals, but it's a unique one, especially at that age, right? If you're taking photos with a lobster, if there's a lobster show that our staff will do. So it's a unique experience, and for a lot of people, they remember the first time they had these experiences with the food that we serve, crab and lobster specifically. So it ends up being a very memorable time. So I remember it very well. I remember the crab legs and the lobster tank, and I hear from a lot of people that they do as well remember their first experience at Red Lobster.
Interesting times. That lobster tank is it's a fixture still. I mean, all right. Talk about how has your family reacted to you getting this position at Red Lobster? Obviously, you were at PF Chang's before that, so this is not your first time leading a national company. But I wonder how they felt about this.
Yeah, they're very excited. They still love Chang's, but now they're Team Red Lobster fully. So, I get a lot of photos from the family at visiting various Red Lobsters, and that's my immediate family, but also extended family, uncles, aunts, even family in Nigeria. They're all following very closely. So, a lot of pride, a lot of excitement, and Team Red Lobster all the way.
All right, take me back. So you're growing up. When do you decide that business is where you want to spend your career, right? You have a medical history in your family. Was that something you ever thought about or were pressured to sort of go into medicine, for example?
No, my dad was very good about letting us all choose what we wanted, what we were interested in. His philosophy basically was whatever you choose, aim to be the best at it. So he was more concerned that we were doing our best and performing at a high level than he was trying to dictate what exactly we studied or spent time on. So I think that was a good philosophy. My brothers and my sisters and I all gravitated towards different things, but the goal was whatever you do, kind of give it your all and aim to be the best you can be. And so, for me, that was business. I got interested in early on, I did kind of the lemonade stand, lawn mowing thing with my brothers, but it wasn't until in high school, I won some money for giving a speech contest. At this point, I was living in Maryland. And it was a four-way rotary speech contest. I won $10,000 for giving a speech and decided I wanted to invest it. So I started reading up about investing. I started learning about, first, I tried to do real estate investing and realized the money I thought was all the money in the world is actually nothing if you're trying to do real estate. So I couldn't actually do anything there. But I learned I could buy stocks. So I opened a stock portfolio with the money and started reading about Buffett and all these great investors and talked to people in my neighborhood that knew what they were talking about, learned as much as I could, and went down that path. And then by the time I got to Brown, I knew I wanted to study business and economics. I joined the Brown Investment Club, and the rest was history.
I was a teenager once. I knew a lot of teenagers when I was a teenager. I'm getting to know a few now as my friends' kids are getting older. I can't think of a single one who thought, "Let me open a stock portfolio." What is it about you that you think drove you to do something so adult when you were still relatively young?
Yeah, I found business and finance exciting. I used to watch CNBC before school. So I'd come,
Come
I just
on.
I thought
Is
the
that
whole thing
real?
was interesting. Yeah, that's real. That's real. I played football, so I was up early for training camps and all this stuff. My friends would sleep over and I'd have CNBC on in the morning. I just thought it was interesting. I genuinely, so it wasn't, nobody forced me to. I just thought it was, I thought it was interesting. And the idea of making a lot of money was interesting too, right? And you see some of these people and
Sure.
the things they were doing. So, I just gravitated towards business. And once I learned that, once I learned how to think, you know, I read a lot. There's a website called The Motley Fool that I used to read, and I'd watch NBC and listen to what they were talking about. And then I talked to kind of adults in my community that, you know, my coaches and such that knew what they were talking about as well. And once I kind of learned the basics, I started just doing. I think you learn best by doing. And maybe, you know, don't put $10,000 into it if you're 16, but at the very least, like a phantom portfolio or something like that can be very enlightening. So, but I did it with real money, and as a result, I really got into it. And then, you know, this had been 06, 05, 06. So everything, you know, the stock market was booming at the time. So I felt like I was making a ton of money and doing really well. And, you know, positive reinforcement of success will help you fall in love with something even more. So, you know, so for me, by the time I kind of left high school, I was pretty hooked on business and finance. And I just, it helped when I got to high school. I knew what I wanted to do, so I was able to kind of take steps really quickly towards that. And, you know, I got my Goldman internship as a sophomore, and then, you know, like I said, the rest is history.
Yeah, it's interesting that you had such a positive experience with the world of finance, because I think a lot of people of your generation would say the Great Recession is what they think of, and they have you know, sort of a angrier orientation to that. So I guess maybe it was fortuitous you got into it a little earlier, maybe before the Great
To be
Recession.
clear, I got crushed in the recession like everybody else. My beautiful portfolio, you know, it took many, many hits. But you know, for me, by the time the recession came around, I was working at Goldman as an intern. I actually spent my first summer in New York on Wall Street during the recession. So at that point, I was less concerned about my little portfolio and more concerned about my career. And you know, it wasn't clear that summer. A lot of internships got canceled. A lot of jobs got, you know, people got laid off, and it was pretty scary on Wall Street. But they didn't cancel my internship, so I got a first row seat, you know, seat to all of that at Goldman that summer. So I saw it more, you know, it was more sort of for me a learning lesson that shaped my career. Looking back, it just made me a better investor because I kind of saw how bad things can get, right? And so it sets the framework for your risk tolerance, for how you process upside versus downside, what could go wrong, how bad things could get. And it also, I think, builds, like, you know, once you go through that, every small blip in the market doesn't bother you as much as it would otherwise, right? Once you've seen kind of a 40% reduction in stocks, you know, when something small happens, you stay pretty calm. So I think it helped me actually with my temperament and with my understanding of what the range of outcomes really are. And I think I look back at it, I know it wasn't a fond experience for anybody, but looking back, I think it did help me to kind of be there at that point.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I'm trying to remember Goldman's, you know, where it sort of fell in the scheme of the Great Recession. Because I know, you know, companies like, you know, people had built careers at Bear Stearns, and they were walking out with their possessions in a cardboard box, you know, one afternoon when they, you know, maybe come to work the previous day none the wiser. I mean, did you feel that palpably being there at that time?
Goldman fared better than, you know, Bear Stearns went out of business and so did others, but Goldman on a relative basis did well compared to those firms. So it wasn't as catastrophic as that. But I mean, it was high stress and nobody knew how bad it was going to get. You know, now in retrospect, we know exactly how deep and how long it lasted. But at the time, you know, nobody knew, right? So there was just this mass uncertainty of how deep, you know, it's a risk. We call it a recession, but at the time people thought it might be a, dep you know, might be the Great Depression come again, right? So it wasn't
Sure.
clear that it was going to rebound the way that it did. So, you know, that was palpable. I'd say that the what I remember the most was just that there wasn't much time for like babysitting the interns, right? So even as an intern, you had to kind of just jump in and help. And, you know, you got real experience because everybody was so busy and it was so chaotic and there was so much going on that you had the opportunity just to dive in and be part of the team, right? And help where you could, and I did that, right? So it was, again, it wasn't a pleasant experience for anybody, but it was like an important experience for me, and I think it did help me become much better in a lot of different ways. just being part of that firm at that time.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're talking with Damola Adamalakin, who is the CEO of Red Lobster. We first got onto his story, I mean, as many people did. He's 36 years old, the youngest CEO ever when he was appointed of Red Lobster last year, but also because he spent part of his childhood in Springfield, Illinois, at his first Red Lobster experience there. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I want to share a couple of messages we got from listeners by text as well. Christina from Hoopston, Illinois says, I was a hostess at Red Lobster in Dundee, Illinois during my junior and senior years of high school, which was 1990 to 91. I then went to University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for college. During my junior year of college, I needed a job and the company gladly welcomed me to the Champaign location. I originally applied for a job in high school because I love the food so much, and I still do. I never get tired of it, she said. We also heard from Lloyd in Danville, who said, my Red Lobster story is about how much my brother-in-law and sister love to eat there. Lloyd says he took his brother-in-law took his sister there every week. I just treated my grandchildren after a college graduation in Carolina. Lloyd also says, bring Red Lobster back to Danville, Illinois. We would sure appreciate it. We are going to continue with Red Lobster CEO and former Illinois resident Damola Adamalakin after a short break. Again, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show.
Support for the 21st show comes from listeners like you and the Des Moines Arts Center, located in Iowa's capital city, featuring works by regional, national, and international artists of the 20th and 21st centuries. Details are at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today with the CEO of Red Lobster, Damola Adamalakin. He spent part of his childhood in Springfield, Illinois. He's been in this position since last year when Red Lobster was in bankruptcy for a time. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. All right, so last year, the news comes out, Red Lobster's filing for bankruptcy. I think a lot of people who are maybe not as familiar with, you know, how bankruptcy law works, they hear that and they think, well, goodbye, Red Lobster. You know, there's even a moment on the Today Show last spring, I think, where the hosts are basically saying that. But, you know, the company's still here. Tell us about the situation you walked into when you took on this role.
Yeah, it wasn't a good one. So, you know, to your point, there were a lot of uncertainty externally around the future of the company. And frankly, yes, a lot of people thought the company had totally shut down, which wasn't the case, but that's a misperception around bankruptcy. And then internally, there was a lot of concern as well, right, about the future of the brand and, you know, future of people's jobs. And so I'd say morale was low, the guest sort of perception was low, and we had a lot of work to do to turn all of that around, but we've managed to do that, right? So the conversation today, you very rarely, you know, we're talking about it now, but I get asked about it. I got asked about it a lot when I started. I get asked about it very little now, right? It's about kind of what we're doing now, the seafood bowls we just launched, a lot of the new products, the new menu. So we've brought it back to life in a very short amount of time. And, you know, that's been an exciting thing.
Talk about the overall position of the restaurant industry. I mean, I can remember 10, 20 years ago, you know, whether it was Red Lobster in the town where I live, you know, Olive Garden, all these sort of big national restaurant brands, there would be people waiting outside to get a table. And that isn't always the case now. I actually, in preparation for this conversation, my family and I, we went to Red Lobster last night. It was more crowded than it's been in recent years. I will say that. There was, you know, a good number of people in there, but there were still a lot of empty tables, which I think on even on a Tuesday night would have been pretty surprising, you know, maybe a decade ago. So just talk about what has happened with the overall restaurant market in the country.
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot more competition than there used to be. Red Lobster was the first nationwide sit-down restaurant chain, you know, 60 years-ish ago. We first launched and we're the largest restaurant company in the country for a long time. And there's quite a few now. But even if you look at just the options people have to eat, the sit-down restaurants, there's a number of those. The chain restaurants, independents, right? The mom and pops that are in your town. Then you've got fast casual companies, which didn't exist back then, but now there's a lot of them, and they provide pretty good food without the sit-down experience. But, you know, depending on what people are looking for, it provides a different option. And you've got, you know, a lot of people eat at home still, right? So you've just got a lot of options. And so what ends up happening is you get a bifurcation of performance just based on the quality of the chain. Right. So the good chains are still doing really well. Like if you look at an Olive Garden or a Texas Roadhouse or a few of these that have performed well over the years, you know, they still do. They still grow. And then you have a number that haven't quite made it. So, you know, our success over the last 12 months is shifting Red Lobster performance wise into that top tier, which is where we sit right now. Right. You went yesterday and said it was pretty busy, but our numbers right now are about as good as some of the top performers. And that's where we need to stay, right? So as long as we perform and deliver a great guest experience and our customer scores are top of the industry, then we'll do well, even though it's going to be a challenging time just because of the amount of options that people have.
I'm curious what your day consists of, right? You are leading this massive company, thousands and thousands of people, trying to get them to make these changes. You know, what does your day actually consist of in terms of leading a major company like this?
A lot of meetings, right? So, you know, things happen via conversation. You know, businesses are like any organization. Things happen when people talk and sit down and agree and debate, make decisions. So it's a lot of conversation. I spend a lot of time in the restaurants. You know, depending on the week, I might spend the whole week on the road. But I like to be in the restaurants. I like to spend time with the teams. I like to spend time with the guests. I do some press like I'm doing now. So, you know, conversations, interviews. So it's a mix. It depends on the day. But you know, overall, kind of directing the business, working with each of the teams, each of my department heads, spending time in the restaurants. So it's busy. But, you know, that's how we like it. So it's always a great day, my friend.
What is it like going to a restaurant when you are the CEO? Are you going as CEO, or do you ever go like sort of incognito, just try and see, you know, what it's like for everyday people?
I try to do both, but it's harder to be incognito these days. So most of the time, incognito fails. So I just end up planning it. But I try to do some of both. Most of my organized trips are, you know, they'll have a purpose. Either there's an event or there's a market that I'm visiting, or I'm with my COO and we're doing a kind of ops visit. So it depends. But most of the time they'll know I'm coming and I'll meet with the teams. And then it's more about motivating and inspiring the team than it is about like assessing how they perform and when I'm not there. There's other tools for me to figure out how restaurants run when I'm not there. So my presence now, a lot of it is motivational. A lot of it is aligning the team to strategy. A lot of it is just meeting people and having them meet me. So, you know, the purpose will dictate whether it's announced or not, but more than less, it's announced and it's for the purpose of spending time with the people.
Yeah, I was talking to our server last night, and at the end of the meal, after we were all done and the bill had been paid, I did mention that I would be talking to you. And, you know, I was curious if, you know, she had any idea that you had this, you know, connection with Springfield, which is the location we ate at. She did not. And she kind of jokingly said, "Hope I did okay," as she walked away. And she did. But I wonder, do you see that the presence of motivation, like, you know, you go talk to a restaurant, do you actually see that in the numbers for that location? Or are you not thinking of it in such a fine grained way? You know,
you're saying if I visit, does it perform better after I visit?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Do you rally the true Henry V style? Right. We band of brothers.
Yeah, I think so. And we measure, and that's more, it's less about like the sales pop, or, but it's more so like, you know, how do the team feel? Right. And it can be tricky to measure, but you talk to the teams and you measure kind of team satisfaction. And when leadership spends time in a restaurant, the team does galvanize, whether it's me or my COO makes a visit or any other member of the senior leadership team, it does kind of place a spotlight on the restaurant. They do feel supported. They feel acknowledged for all of their hard work. And it certainly makes a positive difference, right? So, you know, I believe, look, our headquarters are in Orlando and we do a lot of great work here, but we're a cost center. The magic's happening in the restaurants, right? So I encourage everybody on our team here to spend time around the country in different markets, myself included, because that's where the guest experience happens. And that's where, you know, the magic happens, as I like to say, in terms of taking care of our guests.
So I'm curious about how you become CEO of a company like this. I'm guessing it's not, you know, putting open to work on your LinkedIn page, despite the significant following you have, right? Fortress Investment Group comes to you, taps you for CEO. How does that actually work in practice, and why you?
Well, in life, you know, you get opportunities based on what you've done, is how it tends to work. So you excel at one thing, other opportunities will arise. And, you know, that's my life even before the CEO gigs, right? I went to Brown because I did a great job in high school. I got recruited to Goldman because I did a great job at Brown. I got recruited to TPG because I did a great job at Goldman. I went to Harvard because I did a great job at TPG. Like that's life, is one step at a time. And just, you know, like my dad said when I was young, be the best at the thing you do and other things will come, right? So so that's it. In terms of this particular role, you know, I led the deal to buy P.F. Chang's in 2019 when I was working at a hedge fund in New York. And that business, it wasn't as dire as the bankruptcy, but it was going through a rough time when I took over. And we turned it around, right? We grew profits of that business by 50%. We grew sales to over $1 billion. We got through COVID stronger than the competition. So the results there dictated, Fortress looked at the results there and asked me to do the same thing here, right? So again, it's just performance that creates opportunity, and you keep performing, you'll keep having new opportunities.
So let's talk about some of the changes. You mentioned some of the changes earlier that you're making at Red Lobster. Let's get into some more detail. One of the things I've heard you say is that if you were starting from scratch, you would make the restaurants smaller, right? And real estate is, I think, a big part of the restaurant industry that maybe, you know, everyday people don't think as much about. So, talk about that. How are you thinking about the real estate, you know, side of Red Lobster as a starting point?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, if you were building a restaurant from scratch, you wouldn't need as much space as you did back when these were built, because a lot of the business now happens online via delivery, which wasn't the case, again, when these restaurants were first designed and built. So it is a different profile that you need now. Now, in terms of what you do, there's very little to do with an existing restaurant that isn't going to be, you know, very expensive in terms of trying to slice and dice the space and reduce it. So there's very, you kind of have the footprint you have by and large. You know, we have 545 restaurants, and that is kind of what it is, right? Over time, as leases come up and as you know, different things happen, you can try to, on the margins, adjust it, but it's not something you can change overnight, right? You're kind of married to the footprint you have. Now, what you can do is use the space more intelligently. You can design the space differently. You can add decor elements. You can change the lighting, the music to make it feel different. And those are the sort of things we'll do. I call those aesthetic remodels. Paint, carpet, removing the carpet, replacing it with something different, like a hardwood floor or a tile or an LVT. You know, lighting, music, like I said. So there's a lot of things we can do with the footprint that doesn't involve, you know, moving or anything structural that requires permitting, just to make the space look and feel better. And those are the sort of things we'll do.
Talk about how you think about, like, how do you come to decide on? I'm fascinated by the design aspect of restaurants. There used to be, it's long since closed now, but there was like sort of this hip Asian fusion, locally owned place in the town where I lived. And they clearly were trying to go for that vibe with the food and the decor and the lighting. And then they had like classic rock as the soundtrack, and it just felt so incongruous. How do you think about that? Are you working with outside designers? Is this all coming from you and your team's head? What is that process?
Well, I think you need to have a vision as to what you need to, first of all, have an understanding of who your guest is and what will work with your guests, because the right design for us might not be the right design for, you know, my old company, PF Chang's. It's a different guest and it's a different cuisine. It's a different vibe. So you need to understand kind of what vibe you're going for, who your guest is, what resonates with them, why they come to you in the first place. And then with that, you work with professionals, you know, we'll work with designers to represent that in an aesthetic, right? And that's, again, the color schemes, the design, the bar, the, you know, down to the restaurant layouts, down to the tiling or the carpet, down to the, you know, the ceiling. Like you'll go through every element of the design and work with them to get a look and feel that works for your guests and delivers the vibe and the experience that you want it to. Right now, you mentioned music. I think that's an important piece, right? Music is, it sets the soundtrack to the dining experience. And I think it's important to get that right. And so, we have companies we work with on the music side to kind of get the right experience. And by the way, it differs by region, right? What I play in New York City might not be the same thing as what I play in Monroe, Alabama. So, there's some sort of customization based on where you are. And we do that, right? So yeah, it's a lot, but it's important, and we spend a lot of time on it. We have people who think about it all, you know, kind of all day, all night, and we want to nail that experience, because it's important that the food is great, but beyond that, there needs to be an experience around the food to make sure that people are having a great time across the board.
You mentioned figuring out who your customer is. Who do you think, how do you describe the Red Lobster customer?
It's broad based. You know, we serve 20 plus million people every year. So it's a lot. It's broadly, you know, we're a broadly attractive concept to a lot of different people. Depending on the region, it'll change a bit too demographically. But I'd say historically, it's skewed a bit older. Until recently, I'd say we've done a really good job of bringing in young people. If you kind of go on TikTok or, you know, X or any social media page now, you'll see we're trending really well with the younger demographics, especially with the new menu that we rolled out. The seafood boils have been really popular with the younger demos. So I'd say the demographic is changing in real time. We're adding a lot of young diners. We're adding a lot of people who are trying this for the first time. And so, you know, it's an exciting thing. So, you know, we'll keep doing that and keep bringing in new folks and try to be a tent that everybody can come to and have a great experience in.
I want to read another text message we got from a listener. Sarah in Bloomington said, for my 9th birthday, I asked to eat a whole lobster by myself and not share with my family. Mom and Dad said I was a good girl and I could have one, but they're very expensive and I wouldn't be able to have any gifts, any cake, any party. And her 8-year-old self thought for a minute and said, yep, just the lobster. So for her 9th birthday, again, reading from her message, I came home from school. The whole family got dressed up in our best outfits, loaded up the car, and drove across the state line from tiny Paris, Illinois to great big Terre Haute, Indiana, where I was able to eat a whole lobster by myself for my 9th birthday. No cake, no gifts, no party, just lobster. It was glorious. And she concludes by saying, to this day, maybe once a year or every other year, she meets her friends at Red Lobster. It never disappoints. Growing up in landlocked Illinois, getting to eat fancy coastal food is always a special treat. So I guess, yeah, that's the key, right? Maintaining people for whom this is like a special, iconic place in their minds, while also not changing it up so much that it becomes something unrecognizable to them.
Well, I mean, that was a beautiful passage that you just read. And what I'd say is that, you know, that's a lot of what made Red Lobster special in the first place, is bringing something that was otherwise inaccessible to the masses, right? When Red Lobster started, it was virtually impossible to get crab legs in Illinois or Indiana, right? Or to get Maine lobster. And that's something that Red Lobster has done, is make this kind of elite seafood accessible to everybody, right? Even things like key lime pie, which at the time was a Florida specialty, you know, we were kind of the first to take that across the country. And so we're still doing that now. These seafood boils that I said were popular, a lot of why they're popular is because there's a lot of places where you can't get a seafood boil. There's not, you know, seafood boil places are pretty regional, and now we've kind of taken it across the country and people are really excited about that. Yeah. So a lot of what was in that message is still true today, in that we're, you know, the only place across the country you can come for crab legs, lobster, seafood boils, and So we hold that distinction, and it's an important part of what has made us successful and what we're going to keep doing going forward.
Yeah. All right, we're going to continue with Damola Adamalekum when we return. This is the 21st Show. Please stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Damola Adamalekum, the CEO of Red Lobster. Grew up partly in Springfield, Illinois, although he was originally from Nigeria. And he is revitalizing the company after it was in bankruptcy last year, or I should say leading a revitalization with many other people who work there. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. So I grew up, we heard that text message from one of our listeners before the break about her own youthful experience. I grew up with a lot of people for whom going to Red Lobster was a special occasion. But I know it also has a particular significance and customer share in the Black community in America, right? It was in one of the Madea movies, even had a scene set there. Beyonce references it in her song Formation, which we cannot quote from on the radio, but people can look that up if they're interested in what she had to say about Red Lobster. And apparently that led to a sales increase. So talk to me about how you think about, you know, that particular relationship with the Black community in America.
Yeah, it's an important one. And to your point, it's longstanding. So, you know, Red Lobster was first founded and from the very beginning, and this has been the 1950s, 1956, from the very beginning, Bill Darden, who opened Red Lobster, was welcoming to Black diners when a lot of restaurants in that time and in that place were not, right? So Black diners were always welcome. Black staff was always welcome. So from the very beginning, there's been a understanding that it was a place that was going to have a good relationship with the Black community. And that has only strengthened over time to where, you know, like you said, we show up a lot in Black pop culture, whether it's Beyonce or people who worked here. You know, Nicki Minaj worked at a Red Lobster, Cardi B. You know, I had a chat with Charlemagne. He said he used to go there all the time with his friends. So there's a lot of, you know, cultural legacy with the Black community. It's something that we're proud of and we embrace. And you know, it's certainly something that you know, I'm happy to speak to and happy to be part of.
I wonder if you're willing to speak about how your own experience of being Black in America, although, you know, from initially from Africa, right? And how that has shaped your own life path and life journey.
Yeah, I mean, look, I my experience is unique. It's an international one, especially my childhood. That said, you know, coming to America at the age that I did, I went to schools that were very diverse schools. And in Springfield, I went to Franklin Middle School, which would have fed to Springfield High or Southeast High. And these are just very diverse schools, as anybody from Springfield can attest to. My experience was, always great with the Black American community. I played basketball, played football, so I spent a lot of time playing sports. Got into kind of the cultural elements, the music, and some other things. And that was true when I lived in Maryland as well. So it's always been an extremely welcoming community to myself and my family. Even though, you know, we moved here later, it's always embraced us from the very beginning. So on a personal level, it's a community that we love and we're grateful for as well.
Because, I mean, there can be that tension, right, between people who are immigrants from African countries and African-Americans whose ancestors experienced Jim Crow and enslavement and all that. There was a YouTube video I came across that, you know, tried to make a little bit of hay out of that. But is that something you have ever had to deal with, or maybe it's not. Maybe you have not had that experience.
Yeah, I find it. I've heard that, but I think that's overstated. I think there's obviously differences in experience, but it's not. I don't think it's conflict. I just think it's a difference in experience. And I actually think the communities learn really a lot from each other. You know, I learned a lot from my Black American friends, and I think they learned a lot. You know, I had a friend, Zach Brown, that I played football with. He played in the NFL. But he'd come to my house and spend a lot of time with my family. And I think he learned a lot from, you know, our experience as well, right? So I think it's all about perspective. But in my view, it's a positive. It's just, you know, more experiences to learn from and to build together with. And so, and Look, Nigerians love Black Americans, and as far as I've seen, Black Americans love love the Nigerian community as well. So I think it's the tension's a bit overstated.
All right, let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Deanna is calling from Rockford. Deanna, thanks for calling in.
Yes, I wanted to tell you that the Red Lobster in Rockford is excellent. Excellent food, excellent customer service, and they went out of their way to help my mother, who's 97, with her walker and her best friend to come to the parking lot and open the door. They had a wonderful experience, and they've been there many times. And these are women in their 90s, and they love the Red Lobster.
That is amazing.
Deanna, what's your favorite? Do you have a do you have a go-to menu item?
Well,
sorry,
they're the ones who go. I still work. I'm a consultant, so I don't go there as much as my mother and her friends.
Okay.
I'm in my 70s, but I've been there not as much as my mother. I just, all of the food is really superb. Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in. Well, I'll hand it back to you then.
Oh, that was wonderful. So I appreciate the comment. And look, that's we want our team members to take care of the guests, whatever that means. And hearing that story about them walking your mother out to the car and her friends, like, that's what I love to hear. We want to recognize and engage in delight. We say red carpet hospitality, and that's a great example of it. And I'll make sure they get a shout out on our call here in a bit for the Rockford team. So great job, Rockford, and love to hear that.
So let's you mentioned the idea of it's a little difficult for you to be anonymous now because you have been so front facing with this role. And sure enough, you are on TikTok. You are like a part of the company's strategy, I think, communication strategy here, right? Even this conversation, but social media. How is that for you? Because I think that, like, if you were to, I don't know who the CEO of Olive Garden is. I'm sure maybe you do, but, most people could not name the CEOs of major restaurant companies. Is that something you've embraced? Did you have to be persuaded? Talk about what that experience has been like for you.
Yeah, look, my nature is more strategic. Like, if you're just asking what would I do if it was just me, I'd just run the show and focus on the business and focus on the ops and managing. But I'm good with the press. I'm good with public speaking. It's something that I've done for a long time since I won that speech that I started with when I was in high school to get that initial investment money. So I've been speaking publicly for a long time, and I'm comfortable with it. So, the ask came by virtue of a couple of interviews that I did going viral, and my marketing team basically said, we'd like for you to do more. And so, I was open to it. For me, anything that helps the business, I'm happy to do, right? At the end of the day, my mission is to make Red Lobster the greatest restaurant company in the world once again. If I can do something to help that, I'll do it. It's not a problem, and it's not a question. So I've done more. I actually started an Instagram. I didn't have one, but I started one as I got more involved on the communication side. And, LinkedIn, you mentioned, I'm on there. I'll do some interviews, and I'm in some of the ads. So, I'm doing more, but it's because it's something that I'm comfortable doing, and it's something that helps the business. And, Godspeed, we'll make Red Lobster the greatest restaurant company in the world.
There are not a lot of times where a private equity company comes and takes over a business and it kind of gets like a positive boost in reputation always. There, I think some people use the term vulture capitalism. Can you make a case in your view as to why, private equity is maybe a net good? Because I think there are a lot of people out there who see it as oftentimes the company that comes in to destroy and extract value. And, maybe they say they're saving, but that costs a lot of jobs in the meantime.
Well, let me just start by saying those people aren't, they're not wrong in thinking that. That does happen sometimes. It totally just depends on the private equity firm. Like, they're not all the same. I know it's easy to kind of group them together, but they take different approaches. And some do take a very financial engineering approach of just trying to cut costs and build profit that way. I think it's a huge mistake in this business, because ultimately this is a business where the lifeblood is guests coming into your restaurant. So if you cut costs and you don't consider what that does to the guests, and then guest count decreases, you're going to lose more than you gain. And I think people learned that the hard way, including the people who owned this business before. Now, the new owners, Fortress especially, have come in with a totally different mindset. They're investing. So they're saying, we're going to learn from the mistakes of the past, and we're going to actually invest to make a better business, create a better guest experience, remodel the restaurants, get some new dishes, invest in hospitality and our team members. So they're taking that approach, and it's going to have a wonderful payoff for them, because that's how you build a great restaurant business, is by investing in the guest experience and in the team member experience. So then, depending on the private equity firm, if they approach it the right way, they can be a great positive, because they can inject a lot of capital, right? They're giving me the money I need to remodel restaurants, to hire people, to, you know, improve the technology, to do the aesthetic redesigns I mentioned. So, you know, in this case, it's certainly a net positive.
Another thing a lot of business leaders have to deal with today that I'm sure they would rather not is politics, political considerations. You know, Red Lobster appeals to the to that broad range of customers. I saw somebody wearing a bright red Trump hat and some other people that, if I had to guess, I would guess were probably not Trump voters when I was at the location the other day. How do you think about that? Do you sort of live in like fear that like, oh my goodness, I hope we don't become the next, you know, story on X, you know, YZ news network in America's culture wars?
I consider ourselves a place where people can leave the politics and other sort of stressful issues at the door and come and have a good time. That's what makes us special. That's what people come to us for, is to enjoy, right? We're in a very unique business. We serve joy for a living. I know we serve food, but that's only part of it. What we do is we serve joy, right? So for us, we don't spend much time thinking about it, because it's not what we do. What we do is we entertain people. We provide a great meal. We provide community. People can come in, talk, enjoy, have fun, have a drink, have some food. And that's why you'll see a diverse group of people in our restaurants, because it's not about anything but just having a great time.
How also do you think about, like, I mean, so, you know, sometimes companies are dragged into these stories, whether they want to or not, right? They're not serving that, but they become a part of it. You know, 10 years ago, there was an AP investigation about, you know, Thai Union, which previously held stake in Red Lobster, doesn't anymore, but, you know, was connected to, like, slave labor in its fishing practices. You know, is that something? How do you think about that? How do you remain conscious of those sorts of, you know, potential dangers, both for in terms of reputational aspects, but also in just terms of the morality of leading a company like this?
Well, I think if you consider morality based on reputational damage, then you're not considering it the right way. I think you should be moral because you should be moral. So we try to just do the right thing, right? And so long as you're doing the right thing and you have a good moral background and your values are correct, then you tend to not have these problems. So, you know, the way I think about it is the way I think about everything. Do the right thing, train people to do the right thing, take care of your people, take care of your guests, and you generally won't have these issues.
We're coming to the end of our time together. You talked about, you know, Red Lobster being the greatest restaurant company in the world. How will you know if and when you've succeeded?
Our guests will tell us. You know, it'll be easy. Our guests will tell us. So we've made progress. It's been 9 months. I think we're a lot better than we were 9 months ago. And the guest scores show that. We still have progress to go. And there's a few things especially that I'd like to do, including remodel the restaurants, which we haven't done yet. But the guests will tell us. They'll give us feedback. We listen. You know, we check the comments, as they say. And once we, you know, get to that point where people prefer us to any other option, we'll know, right? We'll see it in the comments, we'll see it in the scores, and then we'll keep pushing to even take it to a higher level. So that's our approach, and that's what we're going to try to do.
Last question, any more closures or openings on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's always going to be, right? As leases come up, sometimes it's not your choice. Sometimes it's the landlord's choice. They want to build a multi-family residential where your restaurant was, and, you know, that's told to you. So that's always the case for any restaurant chain, but nothing outside of the normal, no, right? No kind of large scale closures or openings, just normal course business.
All right, Damola Adamalakin is the CEO of Red Lobster. He spent part of his youth in Springfield, Illinois. Thank you so much. Fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st Show.
Very good. Thank you very much.
We were at a party.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with Central Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski about the One Big Beautiful Bill, potential end of funding for public radio, or I should say a clawback of funding that's already been approved for public radio. That's being considered in the Senate and potentially might have to go back to the House, depending on how that shakes out. That is all coming up tomorrow here on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Everybody had matching towels. Somebody.